Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show on which we explore the mystery of the human personality, the mystery of the human adventure, all through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, your producer and co-host. So happy to have you here. We've got a great guest today. Stoked on this guest, Enneagram 9, Wing 1, multi-award-winning producer, writer, and director. His films include the number one box office hit War Room, Emmy-nominated The Heart of Christmas, 20th Century Fox's The Trial, and most recently, the award-winning Western, Farhaven. He's currently the showrunner. We'll explain what that is on the show. On the new television series, Blue Ridge, you have to check that out. Talking about Gary Wheeler, who is with us today, we talk about all things Enneagram 9, Wing 1. We talk about cinema. We list some of our favorite movies in different genres. We talk about the Enneagram as understanding story and even maybe how it could be involved in casting or understanding the cast or understanding a part. We talk about Gary's own personal adventure and transformation through using the tool of the Enneagram as an Enneagram 9. Fascinating conversation today. Glad you are here. Listen, make sure you follow Gary at Gary Wheeler Film on his Instagram. That's GaryWheelerFilm to find out all the cool things that he's up to. Without any further ado, let's jump into this conversation with him and your host, Ian Cron.
Hey, Typology friends, welcome back to another episode of the podcast on which we explore the mystery of the human personality and the human adventure through the lens of the Enneagram. I am so stoked today because on the show, we have our new friend, Enneagram 9 with a one wing showrunner extraordinaire, Gary Wheeler. Gary, welcome to Typology.
How's it going, Ian? It's great to be here. I'm excited to be here. Really excited, you know?
Oh, well, I got to just fess up and tell people we have already spent 20 minutes talking nonstop, like just burbling at the mouth about the Enneagram, about film, about television, about great cinematic experiences that we've had. We have so much to talk about. I can't wait to share it with everyone. Anthony, before I move on to Gary, how are you, my brother?
I'm doing well, man. It's good to be here.
Man, it is so good to see
you. Excited about today's program. What were you about to say?
I know. Sorry. I was about to say, I feel like I feel carbonated right now. That's how stoked I feel.
Yeah, man.
That's good. I'm so stoked. Gary, we met through Jonathan Scheck,
right,
who's been on the show. Julie Solomon, his wonderful wife as well. He told us on the show, you have got to meet Gary Wheeler. He is the showrunner on this new Western that you're doing. Remind me the name of it again.
Blue Ridge. It's a new series. It's kind of a modern day Western. Blue Ridge.
Blue Ridge, yep. Right? Great. He said, you got to talk to Gary because he's really into the Enneagram and he really likes it and he thinks it's great. And I said, great, let's have him on because, you know, like you had to tell people what a showrunner is because at first what it sounds like is, oh, somebody gets the coffee. And I'm like, no. You have to know the nomenclature to know just how important and big a role a showrunner is. So tell people what a showrunner
is. Well, I'm not sure like most things in life or at least my career, I'm not sure I got it right, but I'll tell you what I did as a showrunner, you know, what it means for me. So it really is it's the person. Yeah, the buck stops here, right? You know, mm-hmm. So it means on this particular series, you know, I was in the writer's room, wrote several drafts of the several episodes, directed several episodes, produced all six of our first season. So really in charge of the structure, the creative, and the aesthetic of it, you know. So in a series, you know, series can be a little different than a one-off movie in that you're cycling in other creatives to get their voice in, you know, in the as a writer or as a director, or sometimes, you know, actors, sometimes you know, wardrobe and all that other stuff. But somebody's voice has to be throughout the whole thing. And that's really what I did, what a showrunner is, you know, is somebody who just sticks with the show and it's their vision to see it to fruition. And you know, in this particular case, that also meant, you know, approving every single article of wardrobe and every single actor who said a word in the series. And if this was a not an audio podcast, you would see that I may be the last person to be picking wardrobe for everybody in the episode. I might not. So anyway, that's what I did as a showrunner, and specifically wrote four of the episodes, or co-wrote four of the episodes and directed two and produced all six.
So here's just a little bit of editorial. What's interesting, I tell people all the time that there are, you know, when you're helping people understand their type, there are certain kind of clues. One is I tell people that everyone has an energy, right? Like a physical energy. It's not an aura. It's not like, I'm not talking like I'm living in Sedona in a drum circle. But we all have energies, right? That kind of we give off. Some people give off a more hostile energy. Some people an inviting energy. Some people have, but you know this just in acting, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's just people radiate certain energies.
Right.
And one of the ways that you can tell type a little bit is through clothing. and one of the things that I say with nines is when people ask me, well, I'm not sure my type, but if I'm looking at their clothing, I go, how comfortable is it?
Very.
I'm just saying, nines are not always fashion vanguards. You know, a lot of times nines are like, I'm going to go with practical and comfortable. You know, like I'm just... You know,
we have an inordinate number of blankets that I can see around me. Yes, that's we're practical, right? You know, and the older I've gotten, the more I have my things, right? You know, like I only like shoes, I only wear Hokas, right? You know, because they're just so comfortable, you know, and they don't. And so absolutely, you know.
And nines can be frugal.
Yes. And
you know, like they're a little bit more cost, oftentimes they can be cost conscious.
Okay.
Like I'm not gonna spend it, I'm not gonna go out buy a pair of Prada shoes when I can wear Hokas. Yes. Like they pinch and it costs $2,000
right.
And I'm just not gonna do that, you know. Again, this is not true of every single nine. But I see it with nines, right? They like comfort. They like... Now, a two, by the way, has a lot of blankets and candles and scenty stuff around the house. I'm talking maybe more in the feminine.
Yeah.
But because they're concerned about other people's comfort.
Oh, interesting. They've got the blanket so that if anybody comes to the house, they can mm-hmm. use the blanket.
Big stuffed chairs, lots of pillows.
Yeah. As opposed to me who has the, you know... footstool close to the couch because it's the best way to nap, right? You know.
Well, but what's interesting, right, is like nines, like you. I mean, you've done 40 plus films, mm-hmm. right? You've done. And let's brag for a second. Name some of the films people just know.
I think the ones that they'll know the most are things like War Room, you know, which was mm-hmm. a huge number one hit, and then Christmas in the Smokies, which has been on Netflix and it's had a pretty big run there. And then we've done a series of westerns: The Warrant Breaker's Law, Christmas on the Range. I'm trying to go through all of them. The Heart of Christmas. Too many Christmas movies, Ian. I'm seeing a trend here. It's 4 or 5 westerns, but yeah, those are the big ones. Yeah.
Yeah. So nines can be very busy. Mm-hmm. They can be very energetic. People, again, we want to get rid of stereotypes, right? Now sometimes they can be, productively unproductive, meaning that the nine, when they're not in a very healthy space, can just get caught up in busy work. It's not really going anywhere, but they're kind of on autopilot, right? And they're just kind of rolling along. That is probably very much not the case for you because you have it sounds like you have a pretty strong one wing.
Particularly in work. When that comes up, and I almost it almost feels at times, Ian, like, you know, because one, it has that like but when ones go to strength, you know, they can be like a 7 and enthusiastic, right? And then they go mm-hmm. to 4, you know, when they're in on, and so I can exhibit those in my work, you know, like
interesting.
Heaven forbid I read a you know. I could read. I did a movie called Mountaintop, and it's almost exclusively positively reviewed every platform it comes. Okay, but if I read two negative comments from some Yahoo in, you know, Spokane, right? Like, you know, that can sideswipe me. And yeah. So that's the one side, I think, you know, in the sense. But I think it's also human nature, maybe, you know, when you
put, I think it is human nature. We have a negativity bias, right?
Yeah.
Research has shown that it takes like two, like all you have to hear is one negative message and it sticks to you like pretty fast.
Yeah.
But to get a positive message through takes like 100 times. That's, it's like, I don't know the exact number, but it's disproportionately easier to get a sticky negative message on you than it is to keep a positive one.
I think the productively unproductive, is that what you called it? Mm-hmm. You know, I think that exhibits itself in me in areas like, so for example, during the pandemic, I'm going to watch all 100 AFI movies, you know, the top 100 AFI lists, you know, because I need to learn my craft. And that's part of that's true, right? You know, mm-hmm. that I need to learn, like, and I love movies and I watch them every day I watch something, you know. But there is probably that I'm being productive because it's my career, but it's so unproductive in a way too, because, you know, let me watch another episode of Castle, you know, or let me watch another episode of The Lincoln Lawyer or whatever the thing is, you know?
Yeah. You know, what's really interesting to me, I know so many nines living in Nashville. I mean, I'm currently not living in Nashville, but will be again in another couple of months. So many songwriters, authors, and creatives I know are nines. Mm-hmm. Like, I think nines are really special, super special. They don't think they are, but they are. And part of that may be that they're just asleep to their own specialness, you know, in a way. Because they have this diffuse attention. You have a one wing, which helps to laser it in a bit. But they have usually a diffuse attention. They pick things up everywhere. But the thing I love about nines in their healthiest places, the ego is pretty well positioned. It's not swollen. Their ego isn't particularly swollen. So people feel very like, for example, actors, artists that work with nines don't feel threatened easily by them. They're just easy to get along with. They're a great hang on the bus if they're a side player. They go with the flow. They're very diplomatic. They lead by consensus in a way, or at least the appearance of consensus. Like, okay, what does everyone think? Let's get this together. You know, like, does that ring true with your in your
world? I think completely, you know, and 40-something movies in, I think this is my 29th or 30th year in the business, you know? And I think the universality of what people would say is he's really easy to get along with. He doesn't have a lot of conflict on his shoots, you know? That's probably the number one thing, is that the lack of conflict on our shoots.
Yes.
Because that is so atypical about the in the film industry. Most of them
tell us more. Ooh, something sounds juicy.
Yeah. Well, it's usually chaos, right? You know, and because it's a pressure. You have a finite number of minutes and a finite number of days to get your project done. And you bring in all these personalities and you bring in all these different people and you throw in weather. You know, we just shot a movie in the Arizona desert. And it, you know, monsoon season extended itself, you know, 60 days. And so every day you're watching the OSHA alerts for where did the lightning hit? Because if the lightning hits, you got to go inside and you can't, you know, and, you know, sun, if you're shooting in the fall, there's sun a certain number of times and all that kind of stuff. And so there's just so much conflict on a film shoot. And so I've always prided myself even before the Enneagram, right? You know, of like, oh, I don't believe in yelling because I believe in creating a space where creative people can do good things. And to do that, you have to have peace. And now, that being said, somebody once told me that if you want to judge a movie based on the lack of conflict during the making of it, then the greatest movie of all time is The Cannonball Run. Because
That's hilarious.
I was like, okay, you know, so you can't judge the quality of a movie based on how much fun everybody had making it.
You know? I was just about to ask, like, what about those moments when it takes you to, you know, get a charge out of somebody and it, you know, you need to be a little more confrontational.
Yeah. I mean, that's the hardest thing as a nine, really, I think and I was mistyped for a while, you know, but as a nine, I can point to I can tell you the feelings I had and the moments when I've had to go up, you know, and I still feel bad about them, you know, and that's, and it's probably 4-5 times that I've had to, you know, stop, you know, whatever, you know, cut, you know, and that, whereas somebody else would just shake it off. And that's, those have been very, very hard times, you know, and they stick with you afterwards. They stick with me at least, you know. Afterwards, and the one funny expression, the funniest one. I won't out anybody who I've had to, you know, or situations where we had to. But there was this one time I was shooting this Christmas movie in the, and it was a Western themed Christmas movie again, the Christmas and West, right? So, and we had a field full of cows, and we could never get the cows to come to us, and we needed to get the shots of the cows. And then the movie was supposed to end with a stampede of cows, but nobody on the production team knew that they wouldn't walk on the, you know, they have those cow walks, you know, the things they won't escape. And, you know, nobody knew that they wouldn't go. So we're sitting there, time's ticking, money's going and all that other stuff. And I'm, you know, and then everybody starts kind of creeping in on me, you know, cause ultimately I'm in charge, you know? And so we yell action, and one of this wonderful camera operator, you know, is in the field with the cows. So I go, we get the scene, and I yell cut, and you know, they're far away from me and the camera doesn't cut. And I go, cut, the camera doesn't cut. You know, and so I just kind of all the circumstances, these people are coming in, you know, we're running out of time, the cows won't do the stampede, like all these things. And I just yelled at it, like it all comes out of me with the loudest cut you've ever heard, you know, in your life. and everybody turns, and the camera operator, who is a great guy and this probably the strongest Enneagram 8 I've ever seen in my life, you know, who loves, like, man, let's go, you know? And he just pushes the button cut and he turns around and goes, two big thumbs up, you know, smiling at me. And I was just like, and then the cinematographer leans over to me and he goes, yeah, he knew the scene was over, but the cows finally started acting on cue. So he was trying to shoot the cows for all the other scenes. I was just like, okay. So it was, yeah, it's a great question though. What do you do when that happens, right? And how do you feel afterwards? Because everybody's seen you as this peaceful leader and that's, you know, your reputation. What do you do? You know, whereas most sets, they just walk right past it, you know?
Yeah. There's an old Enneagram adage, right, that Ian, you could say it better. My nine wing has to ask for forgiveness for, no, my nine has to ask for forgiveness for what my eight wing did last night or said yesterday or, you know.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you listen, I mean, people tend to think that nines, you know, again, nines are like every other type, are very complicated, and we act out of character, out of personality oftentimes. And when we do, people pay attention. So it's always, it's not a bad thing for people to know that you got that bullet in your gun if you need it.
That's right.
Well, and I can be very, like, I've worked on it, but it can be very decisive. Like, that's actually, you know, really not that hard anymore, you know, to just, yes, no, this, blue, red, whatever, you know? And so, I mean, I think that's good, you know, and probably is. And actually, I think, you know, of all the gifts that the Enneagram has given me, one of the things that I think that is biggest is that I'm actually pretty good at conflict if I lean into it, because, you know, I think it's going to rock the boat. So I think you might even said something about this in your book, Ian, something along the lines of you think conflict's going to so much greater in your head than it actually is, you know? And so when I can push past all of that and just speak truthfully to somebody and deal with it, I can actually really handle it well, you know?
Mm. And so how do you do it? How do you do it? Like, what does that mean? I handle it well.
I tend to wrap things around a joke, you know, so I can get away with some things every now and again to start it. But really, I can just speak the truth. They usually know I care about them, you know, at that point, if I have to do it, because I do value people. And so I can usually just cut straight to it. Like, we had a situation recently where I had to tell somebody that the whole entire thing that they had built and written and done, that, you know, we were just chucking it, you know? And so, you know, I just very truthfully tell them the truth, you know, and say very forthright and say, hey guys, we're going to go a different direction here. And it seems to go really well because it seems earnest, I guess.
Mm. Yeah. It's amazing what you can say when people know you care about them.
Mm.
And where they don't feel like it's an assault on their personhood, where I was talking to an Enneagram 8 the other day about a situation I have with a person that I'm actually, there's some conflict happening.
Mm-hmm.
And as a 4, I'm a withdrawing type. I don't like conflict either for mm-hmm. different reasons, but I can get pretty wrapped around the axle with conflict. And she said, here's what I'd say. She said, I would say, Jim, that's not the person's name, but we'll say it's Jim. Jim, I want you to know I really love you. I love you so much, in fact. I love you more than our relationship.
Mm.
And I'm willing to put our relationship on the line right now to tell you something that's going to be very hard to hear. But if I don't say it to you, I will be betraying our friendship. So here it is. And I was like, you would actually say that? I was like, oh my gosh, that is intense. But then I thought about it afterwards, because the way that this person said it to me, like communicated to me, and this person, by the way, is a very successful consultant. I was like, you know, if someone said that to me, I think I'd take it too.
Yeah.
Like, I would be like, I would feel like this person's putting it all out there on the line, cares enough. But the very line that they said was, I love you more than I love our relationship. And so I am willing to put our relationship on the line mm-hmm. in order to tell you something that will be hard to hear. But if I don't say it, it will be a betrayal of our friendship. And I was like, damn.
That's really good. That's really good.
Isn't that good? I did what you're doing right now, which is I wrote it down.
Oh yeah, I'm going to use that, Ian. I'm going to use that maybe today.
Because it's actually good.
I think I got it.
Yeah. He said maybe today.
Oh, no. Maybe today.
Yeah. I was like, that's how I'm going to deal with that person, you know?
Yeah. But and especially, you know, if you're saying it with sincerity, I think that carries so much love.
Well, it's interesting because if the feelings that I have as a 9-1-1 wing, because I do have more, I feel like that's more developed than my 8 wing, right? You know, and so, mm-hmm. And if the feelings of, you know, that everybody in, you know, as an artist have, you know, we've talked a little bit about this even before we went on, just, but like the feelings that you have when you see other people succeed in your industry, even friends of yours. And, you know, that can be very challenging, especially mm-hmm. if you're connected to the 4 at all, you know, or anything along those lines. And so I can't remember what book I read, but somebody said something along the lines of, you know, as a mantra to that, you know, is just to say, you know, I love people and I want the best for them. And that is an absolute truth in my life, is that, you know, I mm-hmm. like people. So therefore, I do want these guys to succeed, despite the fact that their movie just won a bunch of Oscars, or they made a bunch of money, or all the things right. that they did, you know? And, why am I not on the Tonight Show? You know, like, it's like, you know, all those things. But I do, you know, and I think that's helpful, you know?
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hey, Ian, the other day we were talking about times we lean on others and times we might pull back or withdraw. How do you find the right balance?
Well, you know, each of us have different needs, right, when it comes to our social battery. Like for me, I can be bursting with energy in the morning and then drained by the end of the day after meetings or speaking and just need some time alone.
So what advice would you give those who are struggling to find that balance?
Well, first, I recommend learning what you need to recharge, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is it more time with other people? Is it building space in your day to take time to read alone? If you're not sure, talking to a good therapist can help you figure that out so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp's online therapy, my friend, is a great place to start. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Their therapists can help you develop self-awareness and identify what fuels you and what drains you. Find your social sweet spot, friends, with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/typologypodcast today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/typologypodcast. Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously for a four, that, you know, sometimes I think I used to call it being competitive, but it's actually just envy.
Yeah.
You know, it is my deadly sin. And I laugh, you know, I just finished a new book and I'm in editing and it'll come out next year. I'm super stoked about it. I really feel like it's a strong book. And, but you know, I can remember when books come out, even when I have one that comes out that's doing well, I'm looking at the you know, what's the top 10 books right now in that, you know, in self-help or whatever milieu it is that my book is in. I'm like, what do you mean that they're number one? Oh my God, that book is terrible. You know, and it's like envy is a real deal for me. It's a real deal.
It's hard, and there's no accounting for how it's the hardest thing. I admire anybody who decides to do something because they feel they have something to say, and then they throw it out in the world because at that point they don't own it. And it is incredibly hard to let something go and let the world judge it, you know? And I think anybody who's done anything like this for any period of time is going to have something that they felt so good about fail, and something that they actually probably felt okay about succeed. And so, and those are both really hard to deal with. And I can think of a few movies, I won't name them, that I've made that I was like, oh, that one, you know, and then it does really well. And then I've had a few that I just loved so much. And then, you know, the audience in their own way just, you know, shrugs their shoulders at, you know, and those can be, that can be really hard. So I admire anybody, you know, it's the Teddy Roosevelt, it's not the critic that counts, you know. And it's, you know, the man in the arena, you know, and that's what I just admire, anybody who tries. And
yeah.
And I think, you know, but for a four, that's gotta be hard. Really, really hard.
Well, I don't have it right here because I'm not at my home, but Flannery O'Connor, I have a quote of hers on a piece of paper in my office at home, and Flannery O'Connor says that when she released a book, she completely let it go because at that point it no longer had anything to do with her. It was all what God was up to, and you just you know, I've never said this, but honestly, my best writing isn't the book that sold the most.
Yeah,
that is not my best writing.
Exactly right. Like that's exactly right. Exactly.
You know.
Yeah, and it might not even be the one your most successful might not be the one that you would really, if you get in one of these deep conversations with somebody and they ask you, what should we watch of yours? It's more than likely not going to be the thing that the whole world knows. And, it may be the little thing that you loved so much that is kind of good. You know what I mean? I mean, it made me, you know, it just, I think that's a very true statement.
Yeah, I know that. I know for a fact, and this is, we've actually had this conversation with him on the show with Philip Yancey. Years ago, Philip, you know, has written, I think Philip sold 10 or 15 million books probably in his career, maybe more, I don't know, but at least 10, I would imagine. And his favorite book of all of his books, is the one that sold the absolute
least. It's just, but you know what? I would bet that's far more common than we mm-hmm. think about, because I was actually having a conversation with a friend of mine who has had, who's released, you know, maybe we'll call it a dozen movies at the theater, big ones, successful ones. And he literally told me, and he had a movie out on thousands of screens recently, and he said, my two favorite movies are our least performing movies. They're my mm-hmm. two favorites, you know, mm-hmm. and the two that I think are the mm-hmm. best, and they're the biggest, they're the bombs, you know, of the movies, mm. you know? And I think that's common, you know, I do think that's common. Yeah. But nobody talks about it, I don't think, you know? And so, or the feelings that creates, you know?
Yes. Yeah. It definitely creates a lot of feelings, but you know, I've sort of arrived at blissfully, thankfully, gratefully, all by grace. I sort of have arrived at a place in my life where I have real peace that there is so much I have no control over.
At least until you release your next book, the day of release. Yeah,
well, for the first 6 months, for the first 6 months,
it'll all flood back in.
Oh my God! But for the first 6 months, I will be absolutely hell bent and determined. Not to live by the 12 steps as I aspire to do during the rest of my life, where I let go and let God. I try the best I can to make something succeed, but I realize I have so little control over what ultimately happens with quote unquote the failure or success of a work. And the success is, you know what the success is? And I'm going to say something, you know, it's having the courage to having just done it in the first place.
That's right. That is it. You reminded me of a story. Within, for me at least, success and failure sort of go hand in hand. Like it seems like every time I get a big win, there's like right behind it. But I remember that somebody from who was handling marketing or PR or something from our team at two different places. I had a movie that was on Netflix. I think it was Christmas in the Smokies, right? And within 2 hours I had two separate emails sent to me. One was the 20 best Christmas movies on Netflix. And that was on there. And somebody thought it was a bright idea to send me the link that said the 25 worst Christmas movies on Netflix. And I was on both of them, you know? And I was like, for the same movie, you know? And it was two different articles that some guy had written, no, you know? What? Two different people, you know? And I'm like, well, maybe there's only 25 movies on Christmas movies on Netflix. If I'm on the top 20 and the top 25, you know? And then I looked at the worst movie and I was like, I think we were right behind Christmas with the Cranks, you know, the Tim Allen movie, you know? And I was like, I was like, hey, my kids love that movie. Like, you know, okay, you know? It's a great book, Skipping Christmas by John Grisham. I'm like, that's great. Okay. I can live with that, you know?
You know, here's the thing, everybody's got an opinion.
That's right.
And, you know, I had a friend of mine say to me once, by the way, this goes across, like, you know, these are lessons, life lessons that are not just in the arts. This is for anybody in any, taking on anything.
Right.
I feel like, you know, this friend of mine was so wise. And he's like, listen, man, when you're like writing books and throwing yourself naked into the public square, you just have to understand, it's like you're in the NFL. And if you're in the NFL, you're going to get hit. But here's the good news. You're in the NFL.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I almost said it when I read that article and I was like, hey, Tim Allen, I was like, hey, I'm in the show. You know, it's old Bull Durham reference. I'm mm-hmm. in the show, man. Yeah. You know, yeah. Like, hey, yeah. Okay. They're called.
I love that. I'm in the show. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I'm writing that down. I'm in the show.
You know,
just to remind myself when I get discouraged, it's like, hey, man. And that means, guess what? You know, if you're at the front of the parade, you're the one who gets shot at first. So that's how it goes.
Yeah, particularly in when you're making movies and you don't have all the money that the studios have necessarily, you know, and you're doing a genre movie like a Western, right? And then somebody compares you to Tombstone, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever. You're like, hey, man, I'm competing. Yeah. You know, it doesn't – I'm in the show, you know? We're you know, and I never would have imagined that I would be. So there you go.
Hey, I want to hear you guys bat around types and casting.
Oh, types and casting. Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. How so?
Well, so from your perspective, Gary, do you ever think in terms of types when you're casting? And then Ian, I know you've thought of shows and sitcoms in terms of types. So maybe both those answer. First start with you, Gary, in terms of, do you think about types in terms of casting?
It's interesting because it's really in the writing portion is what we're talking about, because that's where the casting, you know, comes from in a script. And so that's not the first layer for me. The first layer for me is typically structure, you know, and, you know, I happen to be a subscriber to a theory called Save the Cat. And there's a great book called Save the Cat written by Blake Snyder with 15 story beats that every movie needs. And, you know, there's, and I knew him before he passed away. He actually consulted with me on the script way back when. And, but there's like five of those that I think every good movie has to hit, you know, and one in particular. So that's level one, right? You know, and then the level two is the individual characters, you know, and I think it's interesting, Anthony, because I was thinking about my strengths as a writer, weaknesses and strengths, right? So my strengths as a writer tend to be in dialogue. And so I think that
Ooh, and that's the hardest stuff right there.
Well, but here's why.
Dialogue is the hardest.
Well, but here's why. Because, and it wasn't until recently, and this is another thing about the Enneagram that really helps, is because I'm a nine,
yes,
I can see all perspectives.
Yes.
Yeah. And so as a, I have a friend who's an eight screen. He's got to be an eight because every time I deal with him, it's conflict, but he's got to be an eight. But I have a friend and he doesn't, when he writes for specific actors, it doesn't sound like it's their voice, but I can sit there and write for, so for example, our Blue Ridge series, you know, we have eight series regulars, you know, or seven series regulars. And one of them is a 16-year-old girl. And one of them is a, you know, 40-year-old mom and ex-wife. And one of them is a redneck, you know, and one of them is all of these things. And so it's very easy for me to hear their voices. And I think that's my nine. I actually think that is more than anything. It's the nine, you know, and.
Yes. I would agree 100%. I think that's the same reason, and we've mentioned this multiple times on the show. I think that's why nines make great songwriters, and they're great storytellers. And part of it is there's this, they can almost merge in the moment with this other person,
right?
And hear the words come out, and you're like, it's almost like they heard clearly what the character was feeling vaguely.
Yeah, and yes, exactly. And that's so weird to say, but it's absolutely true. It's like you have their voice in your head is what, you know, and it's not super hard for me, but it does take quiet. It does take, you know, things that I can't do it in a, I'm not one of these guys who can go sit in a coffee shop around people and write, you know, it's got to be a cave, you know, and it's got to be all of those things.
There's a lot that's interesting about that. We have people in all the time and they'll have written a book and just in the title itself, you see their type and you know, they've written this book thinking this is how people see the world, and they get this kind of aha, like, oh no, it's the way me and my type sees the world.
Yeah.
So for you, that's why we talk about the nine having that superpower, because you really don't get stuck in, you know, as if you were an eight or a seven or a one, very different, you know, the way that the lens they see through.
And I thought I was actually mistyped. So 2017, I actually discovered the Enneagram, and I was mistyped by somebody who I worked with because they thought I was a seven because I was so much fun on film sets. But then they were like, but afterwards you go back to the hotel. And I'm like, and they don't see me again until the next day, you know, like, and they don't see me on the weekends. They're not seeing me. I'm not the guy going out to eat with everybody. It's, you know, and there was this moment where, but so much of the Enneagram felt right to me, and some of the scales started falling off of my eyes, and, oh, this is why I do. So I kind of walked around as a seven that didn't feel like a seven, you know? And then it took a little while. And then I think I had a day where I think three things happened. I listened to one of your podcasts. I want to say it was maybe Amy Grant. And she was a nine and she somewhere in that podcast. So everybody who's a nine, go back and listen to that podcast. But there was somewhere in there that she talked about handling conflict in the entertainment industry. And it felt right. And then I went into my office and I went into two separate meetings and both meetings, people started talking about some issue. And I think it was either political or it was personal, right? And they were in conflict with somebody else, right? And I went in meetings with two different people. And they were diametrically opposed to each other. And they kind of bared their heart to me. And then I walked in the next meeting and they bared their heart to me. And I walked out and I stepped in the hallway and I actually didn't like it. But I said, oh, they both think I agree with them. And I didn't agree with either one of them. And I just went, oh, I think I'm merging or whatever, right? You know? And it was this thing that I realized, oh, I'm a nine. Yeah. That's why this is it. And I've got to, you know, if my voice needs to be heard somewhere, I need to speak it, you know? And so, and then I called my wife that night and she said, yeah, I was having a conversation with somebody and their husband's a nine. I think you're a nine, you know? And then it would happen. And from that point on, I really embraced it and believed it, you know, and it was a piece of the jigsaw puzzle. Well, part of that was my age too, late 40s when that was happening. I think all of it, you know, but Ian, I'd love to hear your thoughts on the Enneagram and acting and actors. I think you can miscast Anthony. I do think that somebody, if you have a role that's written for, there's a great book called I'll Be in My Trailer. And it's written by John Badham, who directed Saturday Night Fever.
Okay.
It's a great read. And it talks about, and there's some amazing stories of dealing with actors, some like really great stories, but he has an expression and he says, tailor the role to the actor, not the actor to the role.
Say it again.
Tailor the role to the actor, not the actor to the role. And so a lot of people will cast somebody and then try to pigeonhole them into this thing. You know, if you have a role that's written for Tom Hanks, but you cast Matthew McConaughey, you know, you need to tailor that role to Matthew McConaughey, not keep it Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
Or even somebody who's more diametrically opposed, some strong Jack Nicholson, right? You know, who's one thing. And then Brad Pitt, who's another, right? You have to tailor the role to the actor, not the actor to the role.
I was just listening to a writer director the other day and I wish I could remember exactly what film it was, but he eventually got the actor that he wanted, but he really struggled through the whole writing because he had such a clear picture of this actor.
Right.
As he was writing, and he did his best to kind of set him aside because he wasn't sure if he was going to be able to get him or not. It all worked out in the end, but I could see how that would be a big challenge.
Yeah, you try to. Yes, exactly.
But yeah, Ian, so we've talked about a specific sitcom, and some of our listeners have heard this in the past, but I think it would still be cool for you to do a rundown of how sometimes these types in, you know, with a series and a cast, how it can kind of play itself out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the two I always use, obviously we've spoken about Parks and Rec, which I think is the ultimate Enneagram show. Some people think Modern Family is another one. These are, and what we're really talking about now is archetypes.
Right.
Like there are archetypal kinds of personalities. And, you know, I have no idea if the person who wrote Modern Family or the movie Lady Bird, which we were just talking about, knew the Enneagram or not. I'd actually be surprised if they did know the Enneagram or not, I guess, you know, I'd be like, either way. But because these archetypes swim in our psyche, like we have grown up and we've met all these different archetypes. It's not surprising when they show up naked inside of a script, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like you're like, oh my gosh, like, like take Les Miserables, right? Like you look at a character like, who was the policeman?
There's Inspector Javert,
right. Enneagram one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
sure.
Sort of stuck in the need to do the right thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, and could not even though the right thing was the wrong thing.
Right.
He was doing the right thing for the wrong, I'm not exactly sure of the expression, but that's going through my mind.
Well, it destroys him, actually, in the end. His character gets destroyed because of that.
Yeah, like his own personality, his own archetype destroys itself.
Right.
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 And it's actually a beautiful exploration of grace, right? Because it shows how counterintuitive and how almost against the rules of our ideas of the universe works, right? Like, well, you know, that's just sort of a beautiful example of where a type is an archetype and implodes on itself. You know, in Lady Bird, you see the classic 9-1 marriage. Gary, what's your wife's type?
A five.
A five.
And I have an inordinate, I had somebody say this to me, said, if you could ask Ian anything, ask him I have so many fives in my life and I can't figure out why. Because they're
I love fives.
Oh, yeah. But we've been married for 30 years and she's a five and she's just, you know, she has to understand it before moving forward, you know, and all of those things. But she, it's very helpful because both of us are very pragmatic in this, you know, it really does work, but she's a five. Yeah.
I love fives. I actually, the older I get, the more I love every single type. I think I say this about every time. Oh, I love sixes. And I do in their healthiest expression, every type. I love every type. I mean, I really do.
Is there a type?
It turns into an Italian grandmother when we have guests on. I love eight the most. I love sevens. Sixes are my favorite.
Sevens can be tough though, can't they, Ian? I mean, like when they're an unhealthy sevens, I find myself that's one that is harder for me as a nine.
I have had this conversation.
Yes.
Oh,
a healthy any number is great. An unhealthy couple of numbers are challenging.
That one. Oh, I could tell you guys some stories about some sevens, and I'm like, especially in the film industry, right? Like, oh my gosh, you know. And it's I was wondering, Ian, if you thought that because I love movies. It's my thing. I love movies, and I love to watch 20 minutes of a classic movie every day. I try to, you know, whatever. But I like all kinds of genres. And I wonder if certain Enneagram types are drawn to certain kinds of movies, you know, because I do know some sevens that can't watch, like, you know.
Oh, for sure.
They're not going to watch Spotlight, which I love Spotlight. You know, I think it's an amazing movie, but no, they're not going to watch Spotlight, you know. And I wonder if that's true.
Well,
you know,
for because I like all anything movies. That isn't fun, they're not going to watch, for sure.
That's exactly.
It's like,
right?
Why would I be doing this?
Yeah. I know a seven where we can be, if one of my girls would be watching like a Disney Channel show or something, that they would, when they were younger, that they would bebop in the room and start singing the song right along with them, you know? And it's like the theme song, you know? And so I just wonder if that's the case, you know, different.
Yeah. I think it depends on the level of health. You know, like Steve Taylor, who we were just talking about. Steve's been on the show. Steve's a producer. He's been a director. Steve will watch movies that I cannot watch. Mm. And Steve and I have watched a lot of movies together. A lot. And you know, and Steve's background actually was in pretty high art. Mm-hmm. I mean, like a student of Bergman, a student of you know, Kurosawa. I mean, he's like, he watches and sometimes, like for me, I find it very hard to watch very violent movies. Mm-hmm. Tarantino movies although I don't know, Curious Bastards, I kind of like. There are some I like, but movies where children get hurt. Schindler's List was so hard for me to get through.
Interesting.
After I got done with Schindler's List. But here's the thing, Steve's a head type.
Okay.
And so what's interesting about Steve is that he's watching as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
He is more emotionally distantiated from the experience than I am. I am sucked up into the feeling. And the feeling, and Steve can be more of an objective
observer,
kind of analytical mind as he watches a film, and he's like, okay, well, now this is happening and that's happening. So maybe as a filmmaker, it's a different experience.
For me, it's not that way because I actually just maybe it's the merging, right? I just love the movie and I can, or hate the movie, whatever, but I can right. jump in and get past the, you know, unless I'm studying it for a reason, you know, in a sense. But it's interesting because I hadn't thought of this because I keep like a top 10 list and I, you know, and all that sort of thing. And they vary, like The Godfather, which you want to talk about a troubled shoot. That's an incredibly troubled shoot, but it's an amazing film. Oh, you know? No,
it's not even a movie. It's an opera.
Yeah, it's in,
it's like it's like watching Puccini.
There's a great book called Leave the Gun, Take the Cannoli that I read this year, and it breaks down exactly what happened, and it was nothing but conflict on that. Coppola's going to get fired, and that's like my second favorite movie, and Casablanca, and all the, like. There's a, my top 10 is a very diverse thing, but my favorite movie of all time, I've actually kind of think is a Nine movie. Like, I think it's a, you know, and I'm like, is that part of it? It's To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, and you killing me, man. Oh, I love that movie. In fact, I reference it in The Road Back to You.
Yeah, really. Atticus, right? You know?
Yeah, I wanted Atticus Finch to be my dad.
Yeah, right.
A healthy one. A healthy one.
Right, a healthy one, right? But you can see how that's a Nine-ish kind of movie and that he's very understanding. Mm-hmm. And he has these moments of the right action, right? You know?
Yes.
And it, well, the interesting thing about To Kill a Mockingbird, I've referenced the AFI. So the AFI, here's something for you to chew on, Ian. The AFI did a top 100 heroes and villains in all of cinema, 50 of each. I think Darth Vader's top villain, Hannibal Lecter's up. I can't remember which one. But of all of them, it's not some John Wayne movie. It's not Indiana Jones. It's not, as voted by the AFI, the number one hero of all time in all of cinema is Atticus Finch.
Okay. Wow. Enneagram Ones, did you hear that? You need to hear that, because Enneagram Ones will spend so much of their day criticizing themselves and looking at their real and perceived flaws, many of which are more perceived than real.
Right.
And yet there is that beautiful one of Atticus Finch, measured, ironic, kind, just, integrity dripping out of every pore, appropriate. You could argue not particularly affectionate, as we would think, you know, as we
right.
have our ideas of affection. Some of that is cultural and historical, and but it is what it is. But it is such a gorgeous film. And I actually just saw, what was his name from the Waltons? Remember John Boy? What was his
Richard
name?
Thomas.
Richard Thomas performing that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he went around the country.
Yeah, I saw that production.
Yeah.
And it was actually weird in a way, because the film, well, because Sorkin wrote the script.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. So I had a friend play that, Matthew Modine. You guys know Matthew Modine, you
yes.
know? And so I did a movie with Matthew, and he did that role. And it was a Sorkin script, I think. I'm not sure, but it was, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It lost something. It gained something and it lost something. I left both liking it and not liking it at the same time, because I'm so married to the film and the book.
It's just an amazing, and you know, here's the thing. So our society, or whatever, the AFI, but I think our society would say Gregory Peck's version of Atticus Finch is a hero. 100% mm-hmm. they would say that. But like, if you break it down, I mean, he loses the case.
Yeah.
He loses.
But he did the right thing.
But he did the right thing, right? Like, so what are we looking for in heroes in our world? It's not what people think, I think, we're looking for. And that's just fascinating to me, you know?
I have to ask, because I know we're getting close and there might be some more questions you have, but I'm just, this is like, it's not a great segue, but you've referenced so many Westerns and Christmas movies, and maybe you can answer this too, Ian. Besides your own, Gary, like, what are like your top Westerns and Christmas movies?
Yeah, okay. So my top, and I just looked at a top 10 Western, you know, list. So my favorite Western of all time is The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Yeah.
John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart, right? Yeah. You know, it's very poignant. Most people forget the very, you know, the key line, you know, about fact and truth and fact, print the legend, you know, don't print the truth, you know, and also speaks to politics, but that's number one. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, High Noon, is on there. I like some other great, there's a movie called The Big Country with Gregory Peck and, what's his name? Who played the snowman in Rudolph? Burl Ives. Yes. Burl Ives won an Oscar for it, you know, plays this character in it. And then Winchester 73, Jimmy Stewart, you know. Yeah. And then that's a good batch, you know, of Westerns. And then Christmas movies. My favorite Christmas movie is probably – I went and saw it at the theater when it came back out again this year, A Christmas Story, you know. Yeah. You know. And then It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
You know, that's probably two. Yeah. And then Elf. I mean, you know, Elf's amazing. Yeah. I try to watch it every Christmas. And then the older I get, the more I like Christmas Vacation, you know, because I have a theory that everybody has, every family has a Cousin Eddie. And if you can't figure out who it is, it's you, you know?
Are you serious, Clark? That's great. Are you serious, Clark?
That's great.
So I'm definitely leaving some off, but I think the Home Alones are great, you know, but yeah, I love A Christmas Story. Yeah. That's the problem. And a Muppet Christmas Carol. I think a Muppet Christmas Carol is a great, where Michael Caine said he made it. He's got a great book on acting too, Michael Caine. And he just said, I'm going to play this straight. I'm not going to wink at this. Wow. I'm going to play to these Muppets like I'm Ebenezer Scrooge. And wow. So he's the straight man in every scene, you know?
Oh, that's
great. And Paul Williams famously as a composer came back from addiction with that movie and wrote the score from that. You know, that was his first thing back, because he had written the original Muppets score, you know, and the Rainbow Connection, you know, and then, you know, wrote that. Anyway.
We have an old theater here in downtown Franklin that's been renovated. And they play them all year long, but especially at Christmas, they play all the old classics and the black and whites, and you get to see them in the theater. It's great.
Well, and It's a Wonderful Life was a failure when it came out. Like it was, and now, you know, it's a parade. And so was
Elf.
Christmas
wasn't,
Story.
Elf did the same thing. It wasn't, didn't have great.
No, and A Christmas Story was, I think the story with A Christmas Story is they had a theatrical window, and then they had to pull it. And then it did okay, but then they released it the next Christmas and it did the same. And then they released it, and it was like, you know, they kept doing it. There's some technical reason they had to pull it for some other movie that was coming out, you know? And so,
how about you,
Ian? My dad, mine are circumstantial, not based on any sort of artistic eye, but they're more because of what was going on in my life when I saw them.
Sure.
So when I was a little boy, my mom took me. We had a movie theater down the street, and my dad was in the motion picture business, and so we were sort of always in. And on Saturdays, by the way, this is how old I am. Yeah. My mother would get her hair cut and get her hair done, get her perm, but every mom in town would drop their kids off at the local movie theater, which was essentially the de facto babysitter, and there'd be a movie theater filled with like 8 and 9 year olds running around who were also babysitting their 4-year-old brothers.
That's right.
And like throwing candy around and running around the aisles. And there'd be like 500 kids in the room, like watching Bela Lugosi, watching old movies that were, even our parents were too young to know. But my mom took me to see True Grit.
Oh, wow.
With John Wayne. And I remember I was maybe 6, I'm guessing, 6 or 7. I don't know why my mom thought it was a good idea to take her 6 or 7 year old to see True Grit. Yeah. Maybe because my dad was a crazy man and she wanted to get out of the house. So that I have a sort of a certain fondness for True Grit. And then Christmas movies, I am kind of a Christmas Vacation guy, but it's only because my kids insist on watching it together as a family every Christmas. So, and we quote lines from Christmas Vacation starting December 1st every year. So, and there are some scenes in it that to this day still make me laugh, you know. So I do have an affection in my heart for Christmas Vacation. I want to just close out though by I know this is, and we are talking a lot about the Enneagram, but I do want to talk a little bit about faith-based film. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about thoughts I've had, and I want to hear from you. Like, I've been in the faith-based music world before. Mm-hmm. I've been around faith-based publishing all my adult career. Mm-hmm. And it, as you know, it comes with, whenever you put money, faith, and art into the same conversation, things get wonky really, really fast.
Right.
I'm in the process of editing a book right now, right? And, you know, of course, the editor, I get editor's notes, and I have a great editor. And but they know the audience, right? Mm-hmm. And so they know there are certain things you can say and that you can't say, even though you know they're the truth.
Right.
Like you're like, okay, yeah, but it's the truth. Right. It's like, right. Yeah, but they won't hear it.
Right.
It's like, they'll have no part of that, thank you.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but it's the truth. Aren't we in the truth business? Right. Yeah, well, not that much. They want truth, but not that much truth.
Right, right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
You know, it's like, we want some kind of, and then I'm like, well, what's the difference then between art and propaganda? Like, how do you ride that line? Like in art, like you're making film, you know that, you know, you'll read a script and you're like, yeah, it should end this way. But if I end it that way, the faith-based audience won't buy it because they just won't have it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's hard. It's like, how do you reconcile yourself in that universe of art and faith? And
well, it's a good question. It's a good question. So my story, my personal journey is I was not raised in church. I was not raised a Christian. I was not raised a Christian, but I was raised to love movies and television. And so I came to that before I came to faith. So I knew at 16 years old, and before I was 16, I thought I was going to be a lawyer for some crazy reason. And then I had
because they make all the money.
You know what, Ian? It's exactly what it was. When I was in like sixth or seventh grade, my mom took me to it. You had to do like a report on a local businessman. And she somehow talked this lawyer to interview me. And I didn't know anything about the law. And the guy, and I'm asking him all these like middle school questions. And I asked him this question. And one of them was like, well, if you were going to be a lawyer, if you would recommend to a young man to be a lawyer, what kind of lawyer would you be? And he just leaned back, and I think he was probably a litigator or something. He leaned back and he said, well, I wouldn't do this, you know, and he said, I'd be a traffic lawyer because there's one of my partners over there. He has 500 cases and he makes money, you know, hand over fist, and there's no pressure. He just goes in there day after day and gets them off and makes money. And I was like, I left that office. I'm going to be a traffic lawyer, you know. So it's somewhere around 16. I read a book, and it was called Screenplay by Sid Field, and it was a very practical book on how to write scripts. And I just felt like, oh, I could do this. Mm. And so I came to that first. The college I chose was so I could get my hands on a camera, right? So I did all of those things first, and then had a real Saul of Tarsus moment in college. Like, it was really, you know, profound, and my life turned completely. I walked into a car, prayed a prayer, walked out of a car, and was different, right? Like, and it was just a really, and then I had this position of, okay, well, how do I reconcile my, after the honeymoon period, right? You know, how do I reconcile faith to, I want to be a filmmaker, right? So before I became a Christian, I was very interested in justice and social justice. And I had the South African national anthem on my wall, you know, and all of these things. And then I went to work for a production company, and we sat down to talk about, it was 1995, talk about different movies. And this was a filmmaker and an artist, and he was brilliant. And he wanted to make a true story and set in South Africa about racial reconciliation. And so I went, okay, let's gravitate. That was the first movie I ever made. And it was a PBS movie, you know, played on PBS here. Mm-hmm. And it was more art house. And so I kind of found my way that way into it, you know, in that I cared about movies first, then faith. And so I used to have the expression, you know, stealing from C.S. Lewis, you know, what the world needs more now is better writers who are Christians, you know, and you know, and so then Christian writer. And so that's what I would say. That's what I used to say. I'm a filmmaker who's a Christian, not a Christian filmmaker. Mm-hmm. And so, over the years, I've had enough experience to just go, I just want to tell stories of hope, really. For me, it's hope is the one theme that goes through all my movies and anything I do. And I just think you have to walk that fine line. But if you ask me what are great faith movies of faith,
Let's talk about that. I got some.
Yeah, I would throw in things like Tender Mercies, Robert Duvall.
So good.
I would talk about The Apostle, which is a movie I absolutely love.
Movie. How about Calvary?
Oh, yeah. That's a hard watch, though, Ian. That's a hard watch, you know?
I love that movie, though.
It's a great actor. Amazing actor, you know, and
love that film.
Sergeant York, even going way back, there's some things in the Gary Cooper. There's a straight, you know, salvation, scene in there, you know, right? The heart of the movie.
How about Of Gods and Men?
Oh, what's Of Gods and Men? I don't.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Oh, man, there's a scene in that movie to this day I cannot watch. I cannot not cry in this one scene in that film.
Okay.
It's based on a true story about, I think it takes place in Algiers or Tangiers, a group of monks during great political unrest, and they have to make a decision about abandoning their monastery. Did it get a bit? Let me see if it got an Academy Award.
Okay.
It might have.
Of Gods and Men. That's.
It is an extraordinary film. And there's a moment in it. There's this Eucharistic moment that where it's almost like in Babette's Feast at the table.
Oh, Babette's Feast is another one.
Yes, right. And you're like, oh my gosh, like, this is like one of these. It was winner. Let's see, it won the best foreign language film.
Okay.
At the National Board of Review, winner of grand prize at Cannes. So I don't see an Academy Award, but it's fundamentalist terrorists. There's a group of Trappist monks. They're stationed in this impoverished Algerian community, and they have to decide whether to leave or stay. Mm. And if they stay, they die. They know if they stay with the people, if they stay in this monastery, they're going to die. Mm. And I won't tell you how it ends, but it is so beautiful. Now, this is the Andy Grahame 4 in me.
Yes. This is a guy. Right? Didn't you take your son to see Manchester by the Sea on like New Year's Eve or something like that?
Oh my gosh, you know that story.
That's a great story because I'm like, oh my gosh. You know?
But I love that. Okay, well, hold on a second though. Well, hold on a second. All right, now that is an example of what I'm talking about.
That's a beautiful movie. It is
a gorgeous film.
Yes.
And
but even Casey Affleck wouldn't take his son to see that on New Year's Eve. I think
No. Only as a punishment. But here's the thing. It ended so true.
Yes.
To how life is or how life can be. And that's the thing. Maybe as a four, the authenticity of it, the truth of it.
I think that probably is it, you know. And what you're talking about, I think, is truth, and truth in dialogue, and truth in all of those things. And so, I mean, I remember for a time, you probably remember this too, that like, you know, movies like Chariots of Fire were the kind of the go-to, mm-hmm. which is still, you know, there's great moments in that, or The Mission, you know, you remember The Mission,
yes,
which reminds me of Gods and Men. Sounds like it reminds me a little bit of that, you know? Yeah, I think what you're talking about is that honest truth, you know, and I think transformation is part of it. And I think that's why I love Tender Mercy so much, mm-hmm. because it's about, it's actually like a movie like Crazy Heart with Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
Is a great movie about transformation, mm-hmm. you know.
What about Dead Man Walking?
Amazing movie. Dead Man Walking. For the longest time, I used to talk about Dead Man Walking because it was a movie that really got that part of it right, I mm-hmm. think, you know. And that's a true story, you know, or she was a true character, you know. And I thought the remarkable thing about Dead Man Walking to me was how even-handed Tim Robbins was in the directing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just thought it was it presented both sides.
Yeah.
And the fact that they show the crime for the first time during the, I mean, I'm a spoiler alerting it here, but during the end of the movie, you mm-hmm. know, and that's when you first see it. And there's like no judgment there mm-hmm. in the sense of, you know, this is what happened. It's true, you know.
It's true. So like, I think about too, we never mentioned Shawshank Redemption.
Great movie.
Which is another movie about, you know, oh my gosh, hope is a dangerous thing.
So I've done three movies with the warden from Shawshank. Wow. You know, the bad guy, Bob Gunton. He's a great guy. Wow. And it's just hard seeing him, you know. And
he's evil in that movie.
He is. So, you know, he's tall.
Is he really?
He's 6'2 or 6'3, wow. you know? And wow. that shows how tall those other guys, you know, yeah. Tim Robbins is. And mm-hmm. And he was 42 when they made that movie. Think about that.
Wow. He seems so much older.
Doesn't he seem older the whole time, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
And that movie's approaching 30 years old now.
Well, I mean, it seems to appear in a lot of top 10 lists.
Yeah. It's actually, I think, the highest rated movie on IMDb still to this day. Is it the highest? Yeah, and it was also not a box office cassette. Weird name, I think people didn't know what to do with it.
Stephen King, man, you cannot mess with that guy. That's crazy. That's like that level of crazy genius where you're like, how did you do that and Stand By Me?
In the same novella. They were in the same book when they were published, those two. The Body was, and then Rita Hayworth and the Shawshank were in the same book, you know? And
crazy.
And two amazing movies. Misery is another interesting Stephen King movie.
Green Mile.
Green Mile.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, just the guy's brain is, but again, you know, we don't have time today, but we have not yet talked about Robert McKee and the story conference and reading story. That we'll have to save that for another time when we do a deeper dive. Gary, this has been like a crazy rich. I'm as carbonated now. I want to say. Well, because listen, we're talking about art and we're talking about expressing the depths of the human experience.
Right.
And we're talking about archetypes and we're talking about truth and we're talking about moving people as, you know, Dickinson, you know, so beautifully said, you know, art comes in at a slant. And that this I love any conversation about with songwriters, filmmakers, actors, where we're talking about beauty, truth, and goodness.
Right.
And we're talking about coming in slant, coming in through the back door of people's imaginations versus through the front door of their intellects, right? Which are dull anyway. But to come in through the back door of a mind and change it.
It's very beautiful. It's interesting. I'll tell you one more story. So if you ask me what the catalyst moment to become a filmmaker for me, or what it all capsizes in one thing, somewhere in my high school years, I started seeing a lot of movies all the time, like at the theater, sometimes three and four a day. And I want to say it was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but it might not have been, you know, it might have been some other movie, might have been Bull Durham or something like that. But I remember it was a hot summer day and I saw it at this movie theater and I went in the middle of the day. And it was a movie that particularly transported me into a world, right? And it was like this dreamlike state of cinema. And then I walked outside and was hit by the bright light of a summer day. And it like shocked my senses. And I just said, two worlds. Like even at that age, I was cognizant of, you have the, if you become a storyteller, you have the ability to transport somebody into this, into a whole other world. And I think that's kind of what it is for me, you know, is the ability to take somebody somewhere.
And man, very few types do it as well as Nines, man. We're so glad that we had you on. Anthony, another good
rich
day.
One. Yeah, good.
Maybe I should yell cut. Maybe I should
yell it as hard as I can. I don't want people to. I don't want people to follow me and get like, okay, they're expecting me to yell all the time and all that sort of stuff and see all the. We can do it, you know. And
well, Gary, again, thank you, Anthony, thank you, and of course, Typology Tribe. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. And may you have rest. Until next time.